As renewal, sustainability, and regeneration are becoming a mantra so we all can move beyond the mechanistic stronghold on the human population, Boulder-based Zsa Gottlieb is adding another dimension to it all. In his book, Ah, The Pleasure Book, he's wisely suggesting we might benefit from renewable pleasure. Just saying, ah, offers a deeper breath into what he's talking about. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Of course, being an MD is only a part of who you are, but believe me, I was encouraged for the world that a doctor would choose to write a book about pleasure, which, of course, is an essential piece of healthy living.
Yes, yes. It is so essential and so ignored.
You came up with a great phrase, no fly zones in our collective consciousness, and there are many. But as you write about the irony of feeling uncomfortable talking about pleasure because of the trappings and sleight of hand as maneuvered by culture hijacking our pleasure, I thought you could start off with this.
Yes, it is sleight of hand. And that sleight of hand is a whole topic into itself. Who is doing the magic? I started out at CU as an undergraduate in physics, and my curiosity has always been to figure out how do things work. When I brought that into medicine during the 30 years of being in the frontline trenches of human suffering and disease, I was always thinking in the back of my mind, how does this work? What makes people sick? And what makes them better? I was startled to discover, and many years into the practice of medicine, that just as pain and suffering are the constant companions of disease, pleasure and joy are not only the result of health, but the cause of it. That is, through the skillful seeking of pleasure, that's how we find good health. And that is something that was never taught in medical school. I mean, they didn't even have a class on health. So it was all about disease, pain, and suffering. But I wanted to write a book that was more fundamental, that would actually help people not become sick, a book that would promote health. And in order to promote health, we need to become skillful with pleasure, what it is, how to find it, and how to use it to live a good life, a healthy life. And unfortunately, no one has talked much about this, and it's huge. It's fundamental because, first of all, we are pleasure-seeking organisms. That's a given. It's not a moral choice one way or another. It is biologically hardwired into our being. So in our pursuit of pleasure, we develop habits. Those habits become a lifestyle. And in medicine, lifestyle is destiny. There was a 2009 landmark study reported in the Archives of Internal Medicine that demonstrated 80%, fully 80% of the most common fatal diseases, such as diabetes, heart attack, stroke, cancer, could be prevented by healthy lifestyle choices alone. And so as a physician, I had to struggle with answering this question, why don't we make those healthy choices? And that's what led me into this really 15-year project of trying to study and go deep into the nature of pleasure.
So considering the cultural hijacking you speak about, do you have a pet cultural myth you find yourself getting caught up in, or one that you find worthwhile telling us about today as an example?
Yeah, I was not raised in any religious tradition. Although my father was born a Jew, he became a devout atheist, and he took pride in raising his children without an organized religion. So it was with great surprise and really some horror that many, many years later, as an adult, I realized how much my experience around pleasure had been influenced by a religion I never professed. And this really brings us to the story of St. Augustine. And in my chapter on the origin of original sin. And St. Augustine lived in about 400 AD, our early period of Christianity, and shortly after the Catholic Church was formed, he developed his notion of original sin for reasons I won't go into, but he was basically a very highly religious man, very intelligent, and was tormented by the lust of his own flesh. So to explain how he basically could not control his own erections, he developed this notion of original sin, that he had sinned, and that went all the way back to Adam and Eve. Even in his day, the early Catholic Church did not buy into his original notion of original sin. People thought, hey, St. Augustine, he wasn't a saint at that point. You're a little bit off the mark here because the Jews never felt that way. You know, they go forth and procreate, and sexuality and so forth was not such a big moral issue. So for most of us, we don't have this feeling of encumbered with original sin. But what we do share, and I have certainly, and I think most people I know, is the secular equivalent of original sin, and I call that original inadequacy. That's the feeling that no matter what I do, no matter how much I have, no matter how big my house, my car, my family, etc., it's just not enough, because I'm not enough. And I am originally inadequate. And that feeling, that pervasive feeling that fuels our economy, our consumer economy, our ambition, our consumption, I believe can be traced to the root of original sin. So that's how some of these notions have affected me. And I was very surprised to realize, wow, yeah, I do have this feeling that I'm not just quite enough. So what else do I need to do here? And that feeling of not having enough or being enough or doing enough is not only making our lives miserable, this feeling, pervasive feeling of inadequacy, but it's also destroying our environment. And may destroy us as a species, because we are consuming ourselves into oblivion. There is a part of the book, at the last chapter, that's titled Renewable Pleasure for a Sustainable World. And in that chapter, I bring all the pieces together to bear on this issue of the existential crises that are facing us. Global warming, risk of nuclear holocaust, even pandemic and wiping out of forests and so forth. Our problem, our biggest problem is not overpopulation. Our biggest problem is how do you control the human appetite? Because we want so much.
Yes, and in looking at that, when you wrote about pleasure and pain being guideposts we use to navigate our lives. And looking at that, how do you see moving away from that huge appetite that ends up not even satisfying?
Right. That is a very important question. Because how do we know what to do in life? How do we decide what to eat, where to live, who to become friends with, how to exercise or rest and so forth? Well, we have an internal guidance system. I call it an internal GPS. And it is based on pleasure and pain. But we are so confused about pleasure, we don't even realize it. For example, What do you think is the opposite of pain? Most people reflexively say, well, you know, pleasure. Pleasure and pain are opposite. And yes, indeed, pleasure moves us towards something, and pain moves us away. So you might imagine that, like a compass needle, we orient towards the North Pole and in the opposite direction towards the South Pole, and pleasure and pain are opposites. But that turns out to be wrong. So you can imagine the confusion that arises if you're using a faulty compass. It's not a north and south needle. It's a different type of orienting device, because it turns out that the opposite of pain and the opposite of pleasure are the same thing.
Which is?
Which is anesthesia. Anesthesia, which is a condition of nothing, no feeling. So pleasure and pain are separated by a threshold. I call it the pleasure-pain threshold. And that explains why pleasure and pain often commingle, as in love-hate romantic relationships, as in marathon runners crossing the finish line in a state of ecstatic exhaustion. Pleasure and pain are very close to each other. Women during childbirth, there are women who have an experience that is totally ecstatic, and there are others who it's the most horrible, painful thing they've ever experienced. So pleasure and pain are actually very close. And because we don't understand this, we get confused. We're actually, I would say, ignorant in the original sense of the word. That is, we ignore what is ever present and ever important to us.
I think working in that realm of opposites, I see a lot of red flags right there.
Absolutely.
If you're falling on the opposite, I just think you're on the wrong track to start with. Makes everything confusing and more difficult, in my mind anyway.
What do you mean?
For instance, looking at the good, bad.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes very confusing. What's good right now could very well be bad tomorrow.
Yes.
Or in the next moment. So when you're playing off of things like that, it gets very confusing very fast, because it moves us away from the moment and what is.
Precisely. And you're really touching on a foundational confusion, this idea of good and bad, of light and dark, and then having preferences of seeking the light and shunning the darkness. This type of dualism actually is fundamental to Judaism and therefore to Christianity and Islam. And the origin of this sharp dichotomy between light and dark, this duality, really can be traced back to Zoroastrianism, which predates Judaism. And it was during the Babylonian captivity that Jews came into contact with Zoroastrianism and then introduced it into their own faith. And when you have this black and white type of dichotomy, well, what that is actually called is monotheism. Mono meaning one God. And this is a Zoroastrian construct originally. Prior to that, people didn't think in these sharp dualistic terms. And if you have but one God, then you have but one truth, and you are either with it or against it.
Exactly.
And it creates tremendous tension and conflict. Now, if you fast forward a few millennia, you get to Niels Bohr, the brilliant quantum physics scientist who chose as his coat of arms, he was knighted by the Danish court, he chose as his coat of arms the yin-yang symbol, which is ubiquitous. You know, that's the black crescent and the white crescent that are continually swirling around each other, expanding and contracting. And underneath his coat of arms, it says, contraria sunt complementa. Contraries are complementary. And, of course, he is famous for his law of indeterminacy, that an LMG particle can both be a wave and a discrete particle simultaneously. So this is deep in our culture. And Niels Bohr would say the opposite of a trivial truth is wrong.
What?
The opposite of a trivial truth is wrong, but the opposite of a great truth is also true. That paradox, until you get to a paradox, you haven't fully explored an issue. And paradox is where light and dark coexist. So instead of the monotheism, which is characteristic of the people of the book, which came out of a desert culture where human beings stood in sharp relief to their surroundings, if you have a polytheistic approach, which came out of people from the forests, the indigenous people, who realized that there were all kinds of shades of light and dark, and that they all work together in this complementary fashion. And it's not right or wrong. It's the full richness of reality needs to be looked at in an intelligent way. And so in Asian culture, in contrast to Western culture, which is basically built around the number one and unity, and the idea of being all one, it sounds warm and cozy. The Asian cultures are built around the concept of zero.
Yes.
And zero is the balance point where these opposites are resolved, where paradox is resolved.
Right. Jia, you write about defining artificial pleasure separately from authentic pleasure. And in moving toward a place of knowing, I think it would be great if you could share a little bit about that, and then we'll move into ways
yes.
to recognize and embody a conscious pleasure.
Yes, I think that the starting point is to first realize that we have been so heavily conditioned against pleasure. That most people, when they think of pleasure, my book is called Ah, the Pleasure Book. Most people, when they look at that, think about pleasure, their first thought is sex. And because most of our advertising is always pulling on these sexual threads, so it's kind of top of mind. And because of that association with sex and then fig leaves and the Garden of Eden, everyone gets uncomfortable talking about pleasure, whereas happiness, you know, we're very easy for us to talk about happiness in public, but pleasure seems somehow awkward and we're being exposed. So first, realizing that we have been conditioned by this notion of original sin. And once you realize that, and realize that it's not some fundamental property of nature, but was created by a single individual in history, then we can begin to loosen those assumptions and come to a place, hopefully, which I talk about in my book, of saying, you know, maybe I don't know what pleasure is. No one's ever sat me down and talked about it. I never took a course in Pleasure 101 in college. Most people know more about how their car works than pleasure does. From that place, we can then, as you say, embody and become curious. Well, gee, what is this feeling I'm having that I call feeling good? And if we follow that experience of feeling good and let go of the fear, the distrust of pleasure that, well, you know, if you follow that feeling of goodness, you're going to end up, drinking cheap wine out of a brown paper bag under a bridge on a cold night. You know, that's what happens to people who don't know how to deny their desires for pleasure, or you'll run rampant and sexual misconduct, as is apparent throughout our culture, at the highest levels, and for reasons that I do go into in my book. And it comes out of this black and white duality type of guilt and shame. So if you step back and you go, you know, maybe I don't know what pleasure is, and maybe what I think I know is potentially quite wrong, like pleasure and pain are opposites, for example, or that happiness is somehow different than pleasure. And, you know, these are positive psychology researchers, bloggers, even Buddhist monks who go to great lengths to convince us that pleasure and happiness are different. But actually, if you understand pleasure is anything that makes us feel good, then you realize that happiness is simply an emotional form of pleasure.
And is pleasure the physical form, then, you're saying?
Yes. So this is where the confusion starts, okay? That straightforward, common sense definition that pleasure is any experience that makes us feel good is like a prism that reveals the true nature of light. It reveals the true nature of pleasure. So just as every image on your screen, computer screen, is made of three primary colors, red, green, and blue, every pleasure you experience is a spectrum made of three primary experiences, physical, emotional, and mental. So physical are, of course, sex, food, creature comforts. Emotional are happiness, joy, fun, play, love. Mental are pleasant thoughts, positive thoughts that my life has meaning, that I have enough money in the bank, that I am a good person. When those three primary colors are properly balanced and attuned, the red, green, and blue, you get white. And white is the spiritual, the fourth level of pleasure, the spiritual realm of ecstasy, bliss, and equanimity. And this pleasure prism, as I refer to it, and discuss in the book, is not an arbitrary division that I thought up. It relates to, correlates to the evolutionary development of the human forebrain from its reptilian physical level to early mammalian emotional furry fuzzy level to primate, the ape, and the intellectual thinking level. So my book really plumbs the depths of pleasure, starting with freeing ourselves from our erroneous cultural assumptions, and then moving into the science of pleasure and the neurobiology of how these circuits work, and the pleasure center and the desire center and their interrelationship, and then into the natural history, which is what we experience with our own senses in the ordinary day-to-day life, of how pleasure works, how addictions, which is a pleasure disorder, really doesn't work, etc. And this is where lifestyle choices come in. And then that leads into the mystery of pleasure, which is where we get out of this monotheistic point of view and plunge into the emptiness of zero, shunyata in Sanskrit. And then it finishes off with practical applications.
So in having a balance, where does desire fit in with a balance there? And where does surrender fit in to a balance there?
Where it fits in is the sixth immutable law of pleasure. So I have seven immutable laws of pleasure. And the sixth law is the balancing of desire and surrender, where I say that pleasure is an inner dance of effort and relaxation. Desire is a huge part of pleasure, entirely fundamental and essential to our functioning as human beings. You can't get rid of desire, okay? And it attempts to do so, like just say no, or the war on drugs, or prohibition, have been utter failures. The only way you can deal with desire and ultimately control the human appetite, which is our desire, is not by getting rid of it, but actually sharpening it, clarifying what is it that I really want, which is a more difficult question to answer than you may think, and then balancing it with surrender, which is the acceptance of things as they are.
First.
When you bring desire and surrender into equilibrium, into balance, that is the doorway. There are three doorways to paradise: ecstasy, bliss, and equanimity. And when desire and surrender come into balance, those doorways open. And for most of us, the only time we reliably experience that is during experiences of sexual ecstasy and bliss. And that's why such a brief experience as it is, that's why such a brief experience commands so much of our attention and desire, because that's where we have access to the source of our being. And that is the mystery of this pleasure story. When desire and surrender come into balance, we enter the optimal flow of the Tao. And the way you can tell that you're there is because the frequency of synchronistic events increases markedly.
Yes.
Events that are so improbable, but they happen and you just go, oh my goodness. That's when desire and surrender have come into equipoise. And that to me is the biggest mystery. When we're having the ultimate experience, let's call it the zero experience or source experience, there's no one there to objectify it. And then the practical aspect is, how can you begin to punctuate your days with many moments of zero, many moments of merging with reality?
And Zsa, your message is to turn wholeheartedly toward pleasure. What's a first step that you could recommend right now?
Simply begin to acknowledge the fundamental importance of pleasure in your life on a moment-to-moment basis, and observe how you go about finding pleasure, and observe what really works and what doesn't. You have to go for the real thing, which is what most other animals already know how to do. It's just that we're confused because of the malware in our cultural operating system. So tune into pleasure and follow it and refine it, and you will become skillful with it. And not surprisingly, your life will become more enjoyable, and you will find the key, the pathway to excellent health. The whole title, if you just go deep into that experience, both in your body, in your mind, as it sounds, and you investigate, if you say, and then you say with feeling, and then you say with your lips closed, that feels good. And that feeling in Christianity has a name, and it's called agape. It's called amen. That feeling, that is it. That is the zero point. And that's what every Christian mystic knows. And right. That's why my book begins with a quote by Meister Eckhart.
Yeah. When you were writing, what was the nature of your delight when your friends and colleagues asked you what you were writing?
I have a lot of pleasure in being able to take really all of my experience in life and focus it in on this fundamental issue and then share it with people like yourself and your audience and say, hey, look, guys, we've been missing this for so long, and yet this holds the key to our happiness and joy, because each one of us is a potential source of pleasure for each other. And because we are the source, this is talking about renewable pleasure, because we are the source of it, we can create a beautiful world. And that's what needs to happen if we're going to survive and thrive as a species. And that gives me tremendous joy.
Thank you, Zsa Gottlieb. For anything Tributaries related or to hear about our guests, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And podcasts can be found where you go to find them. And if they aren't, let us know. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.